Good morning and welcome back to the second hour of Focus 580. It's our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers for the show, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, and Jason Croft is at the controls this morning. In this hour of Focus 580, our guest is poet Linda Beards. She has published 7 volumes of poetry, most recently one titled The Seconds. She has won a number of awards for her work, including the Penn West Poetry Prize, 2 National Endowment for the Arts grants, a number of fellowships, including one from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, one generally referred to as the Genius Grant. She has published many poems in different publications, places like the Atlantic Monthly, the Kenyon Review, New England Review, New Yorker, Virginia Quarterly Review, and others. She is on the faculty of the University of Washington and makes her home in Washington, and she's here visiting the campus. She is the last speaker for this academic year in the Carr Visiting Authors Reading Series at the U of I. So throughout the year, various kinds of writers come and meet with students and talk with them about their work, and we've had the chance to have some of them here on the program, which is fun for us as well, so that we have a chance to talk with various kinds of writers, talk about their work, talk about writing, and certainly this morning she will read for us some of her work. Well, thank you very much for being here.
You're welcome. Thank you so much for making the time.
Something that, I probably over the last few years have had the opportunity to talk with a few poets, and I imagine there are a couple of things that we always talk about. One has to do with the audience for poetry. Mm-hmm. Why don't we save that for a bit? But the other has to do with the appeal of this form, this kind of writing. And what is it about poetry that you like that draws you to writing that as opposed to writing short stories or writing novels or, kind of writing? What is it about poetry as a form that grabs you?
Okay, that's a good question, because when I was a student and throughout my graduate studies as well, I was a fiction writer. And it was only after I got my advanced degrees in fiction writing that I turned to poetry. Possibly that early training informs the type of poetry that I write. It's often has more narrative progressions than the lyric would. Mm-hmm. But why did I do that? There's something I think in poetry's moment that's appealing to me, that so much weight is compressed into the few moments one has with the work, whereas with a work of fiction, the pacing with the reader is entirely different. Mm-hmm. So perhaps those things that seemed important for me to either say or allude to were better found held in poetry because of its brevity, compression, and the way those things might be highlighted rather than a longer series.
Mm. Well, it's interesting to hear, given the form of poetry that you work in, that you had written fiction before, mm-hmm. and that I would it's the kind of the work that you do is the kind of thing that I would describe as being someone not who is schooled in literary analysis, as being the kind of poem that's sort of like a very short story.
Okay. Yes.
It seems in a way, not that it's not about images, mm-hmm. but that it's a little, it seems in a way a little bit more direct kind of storytelling,
yes.
than some.
Certainly
poetry is.
The early work. I think that recently and this is over the course of about 25 years of publishing these books, I'm starting to be drawn more to the lyric form and mm-hmm. and more to the ghost, I would say, the ghost of formal structures. Occasionally, I'll come out with a real formal structure, the pantoum or the villanelle. And I don't know whether this recent focus in this brand new book that just came out called Firsthand, which is looking at science across the centuries and moving toward genetics and the cloning of Dolly and all of this, that perhaps the research I did for that book that brought to the surface all of the beautiful patternings on the molecular level, the under beyond what the eye can see in a naked fashion, might find echoes in poets in the forms of poetry. So that there's one poem that I have in the new book that's looking at James Watson and the double helix, and I thought, what a good form the pantoum would be for that, with its repeating lines. So the form is sort of echoing its subject matter. So maybe I'm moving more toward the lyric because of the subjects that I'm interested in now.
Hmm. Sometimes I guess I do wonder about the various forms of poetry and where the poets, in a sense, give themselves assignments just as a challenge to say, I generally write like this, but just see what it's like. Why don't we do this?
Yes.
Or whether you deliberately choose certain forms because you think somehow because of what it is you're writing about or what you want to write, you think, as in an example you just gave, I said, well, you know, I really think I might like to do it this way, and because I think the form would suit the theme.
Absolutely. You're absolutely right. And I think that you're going to find poets who approach these things in both of those fashions. Mm-hmm. My colleagues who have been writing in formal structure all of their lives are convinced that the restraints that would be the metrical restraints, the restraints of the rhyme, help them to think. So they are writing from the outside in. The form exists. They say, and perhaps not this casually, but I feel like a sonnet today. I feel today is a good villanelle day. And the form is there, and the subject arises from the restraints the form imposes on the mind. For me, it's the absolute opposite, inside out. The subject is there in whatever a ghostly fashion it might have. It's still there. And I think, this might be a good container for it. This villanelle. But it's so I'm working from the inside out.
Hmm. Well, I would certainly like to give people a chance to hear you read some of your work. And I don't know if it would be possible to also read something, maybe read something older or something newer to show how it is that your work has changed. Hmm. I do. As a matter of fact, happen to have your first published collection, I believe.
That's it.
Isn't that it right there?
That's that
I don't know.
Or
maybe you, I don't know if you have something there because I know that you, in front of you, you have some poems.
Yeah, but these are all from the new book. So did you look in that book and see one that you thought would be good for this?
I don't know if there's anything that stands out particularly.
Okay.
You remember well enough what's in here to...
But I do have one here that is, I think it's in the book directly after that, but that is exactly what we're talking about.
Okay.
It's an old poem. I would say I wrote it 22 years ago. It is moving forward through narrative techniques, but it's not a long poem.
Mm-hmm.
My longtime love is science and art, and how those two might cross paths. And so in this particular case, I was at an exhibit of photographs and saw one called Reviving the Geyser. And it was taken in 1935 and in Greenland, and the photographer's name was John Dahlman. And what I'm doing in this particular poem then is using it as an entry for what I'm trying to pursue here. So I can read that one because it represents that. Reviving the Geyser. One man in a derby hat, another in leggings, and a woman with the brown, sensible shoes of a chemist. Just behind these friends is a thermal circle of dwarf willow, eyebright, and heath. And before them, the slack basin, no hiss and bellow, no steam hurling up its magnificent stitch. There is urgency on these faces. Already the snows creep closer to this mild setting like a ringmaster's animals. To encourage pressure, the man in the derby hat drops chunks of pan soap through the quiet water. They sink like yellow skulls, and then on the surface he sees the rippling legs of the woman, his own small face in its black topknot. A woodcock sings from a tangle of willow. The man thinks of his wife at the loom, how often in the late thin light her beautiful arms cross and recross the breast beam with the stroke of a swimmer. There is pain in her shoulders, in his pale neck stretched over the basin. He thinks of a time when love in terms of his place in the world was everything. So that would be a story-based mm-hmm. poem, what these three people are up to in this the wonderful attempt to make the geyser come back by dropping this scientifically evidently proven pan soap into the slack basin. I think human striving has been an under subject for almost all of my poetry. Yeah.
Let me introduce again our guest for anyone who might have tuned in since the beginning. We're talking this morning with Linda Beards. She's professor of English at University of Washington. She's a poet, has published several collections of her work. It's also been published in many different places, New Yorker, New York Times, Atlantic Monthly, Kenyon Review. She is here visiting the campus. She's the last speaker for the academic year in the CAR Visiting Authors Reading Series here at the U of I. And we're pleased to have you here on the program. And, of course, if anybody wanted to call in and talk with her, they certainly could. 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. I'm interested, you said just before you read that piece, that your longtime love is science and art. Mm-hmm. And also interesting because in this new collection, Firsthand, there are many scientists who appear in the poems. We're introduced to not only James Watson of DNA fame, whom you mentioned, but also Marie Curie, Ben Franklin, Isaac Newton, Archimedes, and Gregor Mendel, who appears in a number of
the
poems.
Yes, he's the main man.
What is it about scientists and science that interests you so much?
I know, and it's peculiar because people will always say they don't feel that science is the stuff of poetry, and there are a lot of contemporary poets who are interested in science, and a lot of poets who are also scientists or have pursued medical careers going back for a long time. What is it that draws me? I certainly have no facility for it. I never was interested as a student, say in high school. I was very bad at it, actually. But I think if human striving is something that captures my heart, then how can one not embrace science? That would be an emotional response. So that Gregor Mendel just spent endless hours with a paintbrush taking pollen out of one blossom and putting it into another, and then carefully taking little calico caps and tying them on all the impregnated blossoms so that the bees couldn't interfere with his work, never realizing that that work would catapult him into history's memory, never realizing that, just doing it day after day for the what if? What if I did this? Or early figures, explorers, using white horses to try to reach the South Pole, painters who carefully take time to get that color exactly right, and Marie Curie stirring pitch blend for years to get her little micro ounce of radium. These are the things I think that have drawn me as a poet. And then watching over the last 25 years what's happened with science and technology, if everyone through striving is trying to extend life in a fashion, either through creative acts or procreation, or now through technology, what are the implications of that? So it's sort of an intellectual arc over my entire life that keeps embracing these things.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, it's interesting when you talk about these scientists in that way that I think about the stereotype we have of scientists as being rather cold and rational people. Mm-hmm. And when the way that you talk about them makes it sound like for perhaps some of these people, it was something in the nature of a compulsion, which also makes me think of writers because in so many cases you talk about writers, what they do, yeah, and you ask them why they do it.
Right.
And they, in one way or another, they say something like, I couldn't not.
Yes, exactly. And, you know, I don't know enough about these individual lives that I write about to know how compulsive they were. But in every case, it has been hours and hours of laborious, tedious work in hope of finding that breakthrough. And I suppose that the hours a writer spends hoping to get this done properly is a compatible kind of compulsion, but in a good sense, I think.
Well, perhaps you might read something from firsthand.
I will. I'll go in now to like the other side of that thing. This is a much more formal than I usually write, but I had alluded to it earlier about James Watson and trying his great attempts at trying to discover the shape, you know, of the molecule. And I had seen on probably a PBS special that he had taken white cardboard and cut the cardboard into various shapes and then taken toothpicks and pasted them around the cardboard and was actually at play one evening turning these beautiful shapes, trying to see how they might align. And Eureka, somewhat like Archimedes, said, I have it. I have that shape. So I thought the Pantoum would be a good form for this, and wrote into the Pantoum with the subject matter having come first. For people who don't understand, the Pantoum takes its quatrains, four-line stanzas, and the second and fourth line of each stanza repeat as the first and third line of the next stanza. So you will hear this form as it's unwinding at the final moment, the line that opened the poem closes the poem. So this is called DNA. At hand, the rounded shapes, cloud white, the scissors, sharp, two dozen toothpick pegs, a vial of amber glue. It's February, Cambridge, 1953, and he's at play, James Watson. The cardboard shapes, two dozen toothpick pegs, a vial of amber glue. White hexagons, pentagons, peg-pierced at the corners. He's at play, James Watson, turning cardboard shapes this way, that. And where is the starshot elegance when hexagons, pentagons, peg-pierced at the corners slip into their pliant, spiral-flung alignments? Where is that starshot elegance? This way? That? He slips together lines of slender pegs that quickly split in two. Pliant, spiral flung, one line meant solitude. But one to one? Pristine redundancy. He slips. Together lines of slender pegs quickly conjugate. White hexagons, white pentagons, not solitude, but one, two, one, pristine redundancy. So close the spiral shape now, salt and sugar atoms congregate, white hexagons, white pentagons, so close the bud, the egg, the laboratory lamb, the salt and sugar atoms spiral shape, so close, it's February, Cambridge, 1953, the blossom, egg, the salutary lamb. So close at hand, the rounded shapes, cloud white, the scissors, sharp.
That, by the way, is one of the poems in Linda Beard's collection, First Hand. It's published by Putnam. So if you're interested, you could seek it out in the bookstore. One of the number of collections she has published of her work. She's professor of English at the University of Washington, and she's here visiting on the campus. Anything else that you'd like to say about that?
Just that the birth of Dolly was the lamb.
The famous clone sheep.
Probably was the singular impulse to this entire book. When that happened, I was, because I don't read science every day. I read it when it's on the front page, and I think about the tremendous amount of work that scientists would have understood led to that. But for me, it came fairly much as a surprise, and I couldn't believe such a thing had happened. And I simultaneously felt thrilled and full of wonder and full of trepidation about the implications of what the hand, of course, as a metaphor for the mind, can do. And so that's what made me think about it. And so the laboratory lamb referred to in this pantoum is a reference to her.
Yeah.
And she comes back. Dolly sort of surfaces from time to time in the book, too.
Yeah, I'm really interested in hearing you talk a little bit more about how poems begin for you.
Okay.
And it sounds like, as you mentioned here in a couple of examples, that there's something that you see.
Absolutely.
Something when you're out in the world just going through life that you see, and something about it catches you.
Absolutely.
And stays with you. And then that when you, I'm sure I read somewhere that you said that when you sit down at your desk to start writing, that kernel, that germ, that whatever it is, you've got it. It's there when you start to
work
on poems.
That this is so, I was just talking about this the other day. I was in Rochester. Poems almost always begin for me with a snippet of fact, an image, a piece of dialogue overheard that arrests my attention. And I think that for many poets, poems might begin in a more oral sense. They hear a certain music in a phrase, and that starts it, that sets the poem going. But it's not that way with me. And I think that these often arcane images are out, I want to see if I can do this well, outside of any immediate significance. So let's say that there's so many of them. I might put down in my notebook, remember the ice skates made from the jaw of a sheep circa 1750 in the Victoria and Albert Museum in London. Remember that the 18th century, the nectar of bluebells was used to keep choir boys' voices from cracking. All of these things that are so mysterious. And I say, why am I stopped here in the course of my day rather than at the next one? There must be some significance to these things that hasn't reached the point of metaphor yet, or hasn't reached the point of symbol yet, but it's important enough that it gets into the notebook. And then when I have a free space, I'll go into the notebook and look at these. And sometimes I'll try sort of using friction to rub a couple of them against each other and see if something comes from it. So that's how the poems begin for me. And I keep them in the notebooks until they find expression in a poem. And if they don't, by the end of the notebook, I bring them forward into the next one.
Hmm. Well, we'll continue to talk here. We're about our midpoint with our guest poet, Linda Beards. One thing I do want to make sure that I mention, she will be giving a free public reading of her latest work at the Illini Union Bookstore. That's on 809 South Wright on the U of I campus, and that will be this afternoon at 4:30. So anyone who is interested in meeting her, hearing more, picking up a copy of her book, you can do that. All you have to do is stop by the bookstore. Again, that's the Illini Union Bookstore in the Author's Corner this afternoon at 4:30. I came across an article about you. This was in the Seattle newspaper a couple years back, and it had a couple quotes that I really liked. One was that you talked about not wanting to be typecast as a poet, and you said, an image seems to leap into people's minds of someone skipping through the fields, rhyming and rhyming. You say you have to tone that down. Well, I think that I thought it was really funny. And I think that actually it does. I think it goes to what people think about poets. And I think it's very interesting, the things that you just said about where poems come from, because I'm sure that people have this idea that what poets do is they go out and sit under a tree and sit by a stream and listen to the music of the birds and wait until the muse comes down and whacks them on the head. That's what we think about poets, and maybe more generally we think that way about writers. Yeah. And it does not convey a real understanding of the craft that's involved and what a deliberate act it is.
Absolutely.
And the fact that, you know, I think that when people who write novels, readers don't always understand that a great deal of research might go into that, and that writers would say, well, this is the kind of story that I want to tell, and this is the kind of characters that I want, and this is the kind of work I want them to do, and if I don't understand that well enough, I better go out there and learn before I can write it. Well, you also used the same word. You talked about the fact that in your writing, you might actually do research, and I'm sure that some people would say, poetry, research, no. That's just a matter of inspiration, right? You're just making it up out of whole cloth, and that's really not the case.
No, and I think that this is the first thing that is shocking to every freshman who comes into my class, that except for now, in high schools are doing such a fine job of getting poetry to students earlier than that, but but I can't just make it happen. I have to wait for the lightning bolt to hit me, and then I'm troubled by the fact that they feel that what that lightning bolt does is give it to them fully formed, so that whatever then spews forth can't be revised, can't be touched, because it's some sort of channeling of inspiration through some external force. And absolutely isn't the way it works. Now, a lot of poets don't like to do research and don't need to, because they're using a much more interior subject matter, the self as a subject. But I'm not a poet who is drawn to autobiography. And so part of the joy for me is learning about these other lives, so that looking at Watson, or looking at Archimedes, or Galileo's in here, that Galileo's father repaired violins. It makes him more a human to me in this fashion. And what was the city like? And what did he? What trees might have grown there? And what? So it's a way I think of keeping a fluidity across time to try to be able to imagine these settings more clearly. And so the research is great fun for me. I really enjoy it.
How much time would you say that you spend revising?
Well, this may be a little too crafty, but I write my poems in pieces. I don't do whole drafts, so that I'll start and work three or four lines for a while until I think they're there, and then move on to the next ones. But I don't. Almost everybody I know writes entire drafts, then goes back and redoes a draft. So by the time I sort of slowly work my way toward the end, the poem is pretty much completed, because it's been revised throughout the weeks that it's taken, incrementally, as it proceeds. That doesn't mean that a month later I won't come back and say, this is a disaster, and start all over again, but I start all over again with that piecemeal
Well, would you read something else?
Sure. In fact, if you have over there the Ghost Trio.
I do indeed.
I will read the poem that I was just talking about.
Okay.
Okay.
Great.
And when I was talking about rubbing a couple of these odd images together to see what might come about, this is one poem where I did that. And the second image was I was looking at Wordsworth's house in England up at Grasmere, and he had built the house over a brook, one part of it, so that the chill from the water would keep the room above cold, and that's where all of their food went that needed to be preserved. So I thought, that's a wonderful idea. So this is a poem that came from that. Memento of the hours. First the path stones, then the shadow, then in a circuit of gorse and mint, the room with a brook running under it. It freshened the milk, the cream that grew in its flat habit, a shallow lacquer, a veil I tested on slow afternoons with a speckle of pepper. There was butter, cheddar, the waxy pleats of squash, green as a storm pond. Walnuts, three families of apple, each with its circle of core fringe. And the sheen on the walls was perpetual, like the sheen on the human body. My mother would sit with me there, her drawstring reticule convex with scent jars and marzipan, the burled shapes of the hidden. Once she brought her cut flowers to chill until evening, and told me the mouths of the bluebells gave from their nectar a syrup elixir. It holds in suspension the voices of choir boys, she said, a dram of postponement. And I felt as she spoke their presence among us, the hum of the brook just under our feet, the mineral hush of the plenitude, then the blackened robes of the blackberry vines gradually filling the door. So there the bluebell choir boys and the brook under the room came together. They certainly weren't necessarily experienced at the same time, but the mother's alluding to them as something that happened in the past. And so that was the poem that surfaced from that kind of creative process.
I have some bluebells in my yard. I probably never think of them the same way
again. They're probably poisoned now. You know, they're probably 17th century bluebells worked.
Our guest in this hour of Focus 580, Linda Beard. She makes her home in Washington State, where she is on the faculty of the University of Washington. She has authored, published 7 volumes of poetry. Her work has appeared in various places, The Atlantic Monthly, The New England Review, The New Yorker. She's won a number of awards for her work. She's here on campus as the last speaker in the Carr Visiting Authors Reading Series for this academic year here at the U of I. And as I mentioned a little bit ago, she will be giving a reading of her latest work at 4:30 this afternoon in the Author's Corner of the Illini Union Bookstore at 809 South Wright in Champaign. So if you're interested in hearing more from her, meeting her, picking up a collection of her poetry, that would be an opportunity to do it. And of course, here, questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Way back at the beginning of the program, I mentioned that in past conversation with poets, one of the things we certainly talk about, eventually we'll get around to is the audience for poetry. Mm-hmm. And there's another quote in this 2000 article that I really liked, that really struck me, where you talked about the fact that as you do your work, what you really would like is like your writing to be clear to the reader. And here's the quote that I really liked that grabbed me. You said, in grade school classrooms, there's this notion that a poem is similar to a math problem and that it has a solution, and that much of the reputation that poetry is difficult comes from this mistaken thinking that a poem has one answer.
Yes, yes.
I like that line.
And that we're required, and especially as children, to find that answer and be certain that that answer is the same one the teacher has to get an A. Mm-hmm. Whereas the success, I think, is in the journey, not necessarily having that that one goal in mind, but the process of getting there. So for me as a poet, what is often problematic is that the reader will not know the references I'm using. They may not remember, who Archimedes was or some of these. That my responsibility then is to try to make the journey as pleasant as possible through the poem so that the reader will find another way to feel happy he or she entered that poem, either through its imagery, patterns, through interesting facts, through the music of the poem. So that's what I'm hoping it for my audience, or when I imagine a reader, I'm hoping to be responsible to that reader and not to make things unnecessarily ambiguous to support that idea of trick, or we want to keep you guessing about this. Where they're difficult is in their character, or, who these characters are, rather than, I hope, in the language itself.
Yeah. Well, we're certainly told that the number of people who read regularly is relatively small.
Yeah.
Read anything regularly, and I'm sure the number of people who are regular readers of poetry, it's even a smaller slice of the people who are readers.
Right.
And I do wonder whether part of the reason is that sometimes people do find poems difficult, or they read them and they say something like, "Well, that's lovely, but I don't get it."
Mm-hmm.
And that's the issue.
Exactly.
That they feel that it's impenetrable.
Right.
And so they'd rather read something that they can get rather
right.
than something that seems kind of a mystery and is a closed door in a lot of ways.
Right. The problem there is it's unfortunate because poetry then, the word, becomes this sort of umbrella under which people expect to find the same type of experience. We would never do that for music. One would never say, I find music impenetrable because this particular type of music I can't get.
Yeah.
So one would say, so I'm not going to deal with music anymore because I had a bad experience not being able to understand a certain classical progression. In poetry, I think people pick up a poem and say, I don't get it, hence I'm not ever going to read again anything that looks to be lineated in a way that makes me think it's poetry, when the variety in the world today is so great and there is a poetry to please even the person who is absolutely never going to approach it again. There, it's there, and because it's so multifaceted now.
Mm-hmm. I think that if we sat down with various kinds of musicians or composers with
yes.
their work, they would be able to say, well, now look at this right here, and explain to you why they chose a particular key
mm-hmm.
or why a particular rhythm or things that happen in the piece that if you had the right kind of vocabulary, they could say, now look what happens over here. Isn't this cool?
Yeah.
This diminished fifth.
Yes,
look
right.
at over here, the key change. And look at how the notes progress and how, see, there's something very surprising that happens at this point. And if you knew enough about composition, you could say, oh, yeah, I see that. That's pretty cool. Whereas most people might simply listen to the piece and say, whoa, that's a wonderful piece
yes.
of music. It really moved me. Going back to, we were talking earlier about why poets choose particular forms
mm-hmm.
or that. Do you think that it's really necessary for the reader to understand a poem at that level, or that, as with the piece of music, that it's perfectly sufficient for them just to say, oh, that's a beautiful poem. That really moved me. I love the sound of it. I love
yes.
the language. And that deep, understanding deep structure, that's great, but you really don't have to do that for the poem to work for you.
Absolutely. I'm with you completely. That's exactly how I feel. That if people are interested in that, they can go along and learn it, and that may increase their appreciation of the poem. But the poem should be able to carry its own weight for the reader, whether the reader understands its formal composition mm-hmm. principles or not.
You have talked about various forms, and I guess that someone called in and said, listened to you and said, would you read an example of a villanelle? Do you have one?
I have an example of a modified villanelle. I have a couple of them.
Okay.
Do you have the seconds?
No.
Okay.
I'm afraid I don't.
Okay. Let me think, because I think I've only published two of them, and I'm not sure that I actually have a copy of one. What is the other one that I did? Let me just take a look. After a while, you're in the Ghost Trio.
The Ghost Trio. Okay. Mm-hmm.
And what's this?
That's firsthand.
Oh, that's firsthand. That I don't believe I have a villanelle in there. It's a beautiful form, and I might have a villanelle in firsthand. Let me take a look at this.
Yeah. While she pages through here looking for the poem. Let me just mention one more time, Linda Beards is our guest. And I do want to mention, again, because I didn't really at the beginning of the program, that she's going to be doing a reading at the Atlanta Union Bookstore today, 4:30 this afternoon, in the Author's Corner. So if you're interested in hearing more from her, you can stop by there. I'm sure anyone who is interested should feel welcome. And, of course, any good bookstore should be able to come up with some of her books that if you're interested in reading some of her work.
I think
the answer is probably, I'm sorry, caller, no.
I'm so sorry.
No villanelles for you today.
What's going to happen as soon as I leave, I'm going to say, Linda, why didn't you think you had, and it's just, it's the only one I can remember is in that book that we don't happen to have here
this
moment.
Well, choose something else.
Okay. I will read one of the poems, the first poem that begins the new book. Firsthand. I'm looking at the globe, the orb, the ovum, the atom, all of these circular shapes in this particular book. And one of them that I just fell in love with was in the 17th century, people had these massive celestial globes that they had carved out. They had little trap doors. They would walk into them and sit on benches inside these celestial globes. On the ceiling, they had painted the constellations. Occasionally, there'd be a little planet dangling by a ribbon. And there they would be with the true constellations and sky just above the construct they had made. So this poem is looking at that and also contemporary life. It's called Time and Space. Deep space, the oblong twinkleless stars matte as wax pears, and the astronauts are losing heart, the heady lisp of auricle and ventricle fading to a whisper as muscles shrink to infants' hearts or the plum-shaped nubs of swans. Atrophy, from time and space, even as the space and time contracts. And how much safer it was, ascension, at some earlier contraction, each flyer intact, cupped by a room-sized celestial globe staked to a palace lawn. How much easier to duck with the doublets and powdered wigs through the flap of a trap door and watch on a soot-stained copper sky the painted constellations, or, dead center, a fist of shadowed earth dangling from a ribbon. All systems go, of course, each moist, diminishing heart just sufficient at its terminus to fuel the arm, the opening hand, to coax to the lips a fig or pleated straw. Still, how much easier to drift in a hollow globe, its perpetual tallow-lit night, while outside with the mazes and spaniels, the day like an onion arced up in layers to the dark heavens. How much safer to enter a time, a space, when a swan might lift from a palace pond to cross for an instant, above, below, its outstretched Cygnus shape, just a membrane and membrane away. A space in time when such accident was prophecy, and such singular alignment, carbon, shadow, membrane, flight, sufficient for the moment.
As a teacher, I wonder when people come into your classroom, whether it's more likely that someone would come in perhaps with the right inner stuff, so to speak,
yes,
and simply someone who needs to have the tools,
mm-hmm,
or how many people come in maybe with somehow with a mistaken notion of what being a poet is, and you think to yourself, what in the world ever gave you the idea that you wanted to be a poet? Because you don't really even quite get
right
what it means.
Well, I think that what happens is the course, if one is going to go forward and minor in creative writing with a poetry emphasis, there's so many courses one takes, and that first one at the beginning, where they may come in with a sense of, as we said, about the lightning bolt strike we need and all of this, that's beaten out of them immediately, because through all of the concrete exercises that are given, this sense that one must get away from self-indulgent abstraction and find the stuff of the world to use. And so within the first 3 weeks, I think the poets start to realize this is something other than what I thought. And I almost always, they're engaged and excited because this is something they hadn't thought about. As we were discussing, mm-hmm, with the revision and the time and the research. So I would never say as a teacher that this person has the stuff of it and this one doesn't so early. It would take, and I don't know if I would ever say that to someone who was in the university.
Yeah. I'm sure that there are people who want to be novelists and, mm-hmm, people who maybe have a knack for the story.
Right.
As a form, are there many people who come in to creative writing wanting to be poets?
There are people who come in to my poetry classes and those of my colleagues wanting to improve their musical skills with language. And after they've been with us for a quarter, are absolutely on a track to want to be poets. It happens every class, and I think it's grand. The only problem we have is when their parents want them to be doctors, and then they come in and say, what have you done to my child? They will have no viable employment in their lives. But yes, it grabs them.
Yeah. Well, I suppose one could be both. I think there have been writers who have been doctors, or doctors have been writers.
Examples of that in time.
Yeah. Something else that I want to mention that says something about how poorly we reward writers. This also is something that comes out of that piece that I mentioned from the Seattle paper, mm-hmm, in 2000. I mentioned the fact that some of your work has been published in the New Yorker. And what it says in this piece, at least this was in 2000, that the New Yorker pays poets by the line.
Correct.
$10 a line. That's what it was then. And that that fiction writers are generally paid by the word. And so if you sell a short story to the New Yorker, you might make a couple $1,000. If you sell a poem, it sounds like you'd be lucky to make 150.
Well, it depends. Now, if you make your lines really short and you've got about 75 of them, you're in good shape. No, and I'm not sure now what the New Yorker is paying. It's been a couple of years since I've been in there. But generally, about $500 for a poem. So no, that's you're not going to get rich doing this.
Well, at that, with that piece of inspiration for all the poets out there, we're going to have to stop. But again, for people who are here in and around Champaign-Urbana, our guest, Linda Beards from University of Washington, will be giving a free public reading of her latest work, at the Alina Union Bookstore in the Author's Corner. That's on South Wright, 809 South Wright in the campus. That's on the Champaign side of the street. And anybody who is interested should feel welcome. And I want to thank you very much for being
here.
Well,
it's my pleasure. Thank you so much.